Hello and welcome, everyone. My name is Martin Grant, and I am still the Dean of Science at McGill University. I really regret not having been here the last couple of weeks when I've heard there have been some great talks, and I've already set up mechanisms in play to bring back some of our speakers for other events in the coming fall during homecoming. I'm hopeful to bring back Astronaut Dave in the fall. We'll see what we can do. I like to take credit for all activities that go on in the Faculty of Science, whether they be academic, scientific, or otherwise, but occasionally I feel compelled to give credit to the people who've actually done the work rather than take credit for it all myself. And if you'll indulge me, however briefly, let me tell you the people who've actually done the work over the last 7 weeks when I've occasionally showed up as kind of the straight man MC. First, I want to thank Cappy Flanders and her team for starting the mini-series at McGill. It's been a great success starting with the mini-med series. It's, to my mind, a brilliant idea to get people re-engaged, not just for one lecture, but a series of lectures to get a sense of what is going on in the community of scholars at the university. Cappy can't be here tonight because she's in Jerusalem. The organizer for today, actually for all 7 weeks, is standing right there, Dolores Leprat. She has organized everybody here. Thanks to the students from the Physics Undergraduate Society and the Science Undergraduate Society who have been making me and other MCs look good by fielding the questions and bringing us the extra cool questions. This is exactly like a course, you know. So in a course, the trick is, if you want to get people to ask questions, you just stop talking and wait. And in this new job I have, you stop talking, you'll get an applause line. It's so amazing. Let me read the other people. You've met them all in front, all the people from in the faculty offices and departmental offices who've been filling out the forms and giving you the your pens and all your sort of mini-science paraphernalia. And I'll just read all the names, and then perhaps we could have a round of applause afterwards rather than before. First, Alba Alba. Martine Dolmer, Anne Kozowski, Kelly Cornford, Tony Beliveau, Anna Campana, Catherine Peterson, Marisa Mastro-Berardino, Erica Besso, and Victor Chisholm. All these people are volunteers here. And with that, it's back on me, where the focus will be for another 5 minutes. This is the last of this year's mini-science lecture. I don't know what we'll do next year, but we'll have another mini-science series. And just like the first one was on the brain, and the next one was on extinction and evolution, and this one was on to infinity and beyond, we'll do some other wild thing a year from now. I don't know what it will be. Last week, Dr. Dave Williams gave a lecture entitled Up or Down, the Body's Plasticity in Exploring Inner and Outer Space. And if you weren't there, like me, here's some of what you missed. How the body and brain react to microgravity, current research in preparation for future lunar return missions and missions to Mars, and some personal anecdotes of Dave and his experiences in outer space. You can visit the Faculty of Science blog, which is over there, if you're curious, for a podcast of Dave's lecture if you weren't here. It'll be posted by the end of next week. Some of the answers to questions and mini quizzes are also on these websites if you would like to check them out. Now, since this is a science mini series, we have, of course, a series of compelling skill testing questions. I remind people there will be no wagering on the answers here, and there's no special results for anyway. So I have a list of four questions, which I know the answers to because I have them right here. Question one, due to zero gravity, fluid in the body shifts upwards to the face and head. What is this effect commonly referred to as? Puffy face syndrome. Yes, congratulations. Thank you. Referring to the loss of fluid in each leg is also acceptable. Bird legs. Okay, so they're listen astronaut Dave. So most astronauts have more trouble readapting to Earth's gravity than adapting to microgravity in orbit. Why is that? Pardon me? I think that's a winning answer. So my answer here is their muscles and bones have weakened, exactly what you said, making it difficult to walk. And it's kind of interesting. The heart has to recondition itself to pump blood harder to overcome gravity. And finally, how fast is a space shuttle takeoff and how fast is it traveling in orbit? I'll give you a hint because it's about the same speed as Superman. Pardon me? 8 kilometers per second faster than a speeding bullet. Thank you. Okay. So at the end of tonight's lecture, again, we do the same thing every time. You write down questions, and they'll be sorted and given to me, and I'll ask questions, which will make me look like I understand the lecture. If we can't answer them all, we'll refer some of the best questions to be answered later, and they'll be posted on the website over there. Please complete the evaluation form for today's lecture in addition to the evaluation form for the series. Your feedback is important to us and gives us an idea what we're going to do next year. And there are other things I'm supposed to do, but I haven't done. Please turn off your cell phone so it doesn't interrupt the talk, and I'll do the same thing. I remind people that as in a test, legibility of what's written on the pieces of paper does not count for your final grade in the course, but is appreciated by the instructor. Okay, today's lecture is Wayne Pollard. Wayne is professor in the Department of Geography. He's chair of the Canadian Committee for Antarctic Research, director of the Center for Climate and Global Change Research, and director of the McGill Arctic Research Station on Axel Heiborg Island. Wayne began his career first as an exploration geologist and then moved to his current area of research as a permafrost geomorphologist. This means that Wayne willingly lives and works several months a year in the extreme environment of the Arctic. His research focuses on understanding the evolution of polar landscapes, the analysis of dynamic relationships between climate and terrestrial systems. And this relates to another of Professor Pollard's interests, the idea of the Arctic as a planetary analog. In today's talk, he'll describe Canadian Space Agency and NASA-sponsored analog research taking place at the McGill Arctic Research Station, acronym MARS, and how it is helping provide clues on how we will explore Mars in the future. You can read more about Wayne and his research in the biography enclosed with your packages. And with that, it's all yours.
Thank you, still Dean Grant. Basically, I want to say thank you very much for inviting me to participate in the Mini Science Series, because I really get excited at any opportunity to talk about, first of all, the Arctic, to talk about my science in the Arctic, and also to basically introduce people to aspects of the Canadian North that most people aren't aware of. So as, I got to advance it. So basically, my talk is built around the use of analogs to understand Martian and non-terrestrial environments, and in particular the use of the Arctic, the Antarctic, to explain and to develop space exploration strategies. My talk will be divided into basically three sections. An introduction, I recognize the fact that can be a very specialized environment. I'm sure that my previous, the colleagues at previous speakers in astrophysics must have had a major challenge in breaking their science into a very understandable, because that stuff is it's really out there. I consider my stuff not so far out there in a terrestrial space sense, but I think it's equally demanding. So I'll give a bit of background. And I want to introduce the concept of analogs, because it's more than looks like, smells like, and glad I didn't step in it. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of people think analog science is about when it comes to trying to understand environments like the Mars landscape, Martian landscapes. And so I want to talk a little bit about analogs and give some examples from the Arctic and the Antarctic, and then basically give a bit more detail about the research program that is going on at the Mars site, the McGill Arctic Research Station, Canadian Analog Research Network site on Axelheiberg Island. And the three areas that I want to highlight are areas where my own research is active, as well as colleagues here from McGill. So basically I have three objectives. My first objective is to review some of the basic requirements for space exploration and the benefits that we get from using analogs found here on Earth. Secondly, to show that research activities in the high Arctic provide space science with an excellent opportunity to develop space exploration strategies. And this is an area where Canada has a unique opportunity to become a very active and dynamic member of the international space exploration environment. And then, obviously, the third is to highlight the activities of the McGill Arctic Research Station on Axelheiberg Island. Very quickly, as Dean Grant basically gave you a quick bio, the thing is that I want to point out is I'm old school. You know, the training as an exploration geologist means that I spent many, many months sleeping on the ground, and I still do that. That's why in the very first lecture I was talking to you from Axelheiberg Island, and the technology that we brought to that presentation is actually a fairly cutting-edge technology to be able to communicate with a streaming video from essentially a place that we were told couldn't be done. We were told that satellite communications were impossible at 80 degrees north, given problems with atmospherics, topography, and so on. The fact that we overcame that challenge makes it a fairly significant accomplishment that even fits within the analog framework of this talk. Very simply, though, old school. I've been kicking around this kind of science for about 33 years. I began my Arctic research really as an undergrad doing prospecting in the Arctic. And then it's just continued on. And then about 12 years ago, I began working in the Antarctic. Canada has a very small but dynamic Antarctic research community. And as the chair of the Canadian Committee for Antarctic Research, our biggest goal is to, in fact, get Canada to recognize its contribution in Antarctic science and to create an Antarctic research program. And one might think this is a logical direction that Canada may want to go with its polar interests. It's surprising how much resistance there is to such a thing. And then about 12 years ago, I was abducted, one might say, by a NASA colleague. And it was very coincidental how this whole process came about. He was visiting our Axelheiberg station because of a paper that was written, that I wrote, that was about something unrelated to Mars exploration or Mars analogs. I wrote a paper about a series of perennial springs. And as I'll explain through this talk, these perennial springs are pretty unusual. In fact, they're virtually unique given the setting of Axelheiberg Island. And so I was contacted by Chris McKay, and some of you may remember Chris McKay from his talk in the Trache Origins conference or seminar series last year. Chris McKay is a very good friend of McGill. He has participated in our science for quite a few years. He's part of the ENSERC CREATE astrobiology ENSERC-funded program, which has just been funded. He's been very good to us in terms of working with us in science and supporting our space science. So Chris came north, and essentially from that day on, he's mined my interests in permafrost. I had no interest in space exploration other than the fact that I applied to the original astronaut program that chose Mark Garneau and Dave Williams. And I was an early rejection, which really tears me apart. But apart from that, I had absolutely no scientific interest in space exploration until Chris McKay abducted me. And I have a bit of a confession. As a child, you know, there were two things that were near and dear to me. One was the Arctic, and the notion of the Arctic as a challenging environment for exploration, and the other was science fiction. And it was a very, very hard day in my life when I found out that Martians were little green bacteria at best. And so, I'm kind of glad that I can get into this kind of science. Now, very quickly, I want to introduce the concept of permafrost, because this is very important to most of the things that I want to talk about today. And permafrost is a thermal condition of the ground that basically is ground that remains below freezing, below 0 degrees centigrade, continuously for a minimum period of 2 years. So in other words, it the ground freezes, it remains frozen through the winter, the following summer, and the following winter, and bingo, it qualifies as permafrost. That is part of the permafrost environment in Canada, which is very transient. It comes and goes on a decadal type scale. It's an area called discontinuous permafrost, in fact, sporadic permafrost. It's only in the far north, when we get up into the Arctic Islands and the northern part of the contiguous part of Canada, that we have deep continuous permafrost. The fact that Canada is under land 50% by permafrost is a fact that most people aren't aware of, that 25% of the Earth's land surface is underlain by permafrost, should hit home to everyone the importance of understanding the properties and the behavior in both a geologic, physics, geological engineering sense, and basically understanding the dynamics of it. So essentially, these diagrams give you a sense of the spatial distribution and the vertical distribution of permafrost. To give you a good sense of how significant it can be, the deepest permafrost in the world is about 1,500 meters. More than a kilometer propagates deep into the ground. In northern Canada, it propagates to a depth of about 700-800 meters at its deepest. That means that from the ground surface to 700 meters is below 0 degrees centigrade. You try to drill, you try to get water, you ask yourself, how does groundwater behave in this environment? There's a whole array of dynamic processes, natural processes, which are disrupted by this presence of cryotic or frozen ground. And then another feature that's very important is, since it's below 0 degrees centigrade, any moisture that was in the ground when it became frozen, and there's some very complex processes that take place as freezing progresses that in fact enriches potential accumulations of moisture, turns to ice, and this is called ground ice. And here we have a couple of pictures of natural exposures in the Arctic of permafrost with ground ice. And so very quickly, this is almost pure ice. There's a person standing there, that's one of my grad students. They're known as the Chosen Frozen. I call them that, they call me other things. And most of them aren't repeatable here. And to give you a sense, though, of the scale here, this guy's almost 2 meters tall. This little skin of organics and soil on the top is a little thin layer that seasonally freezes and thaws. And it's in that little thin layer that you get a bit of vegetation. Below this, we have almost 20 meters of pure ice. This is a block of ice that came from this exposure. It's ice in terms of its volumetric ice content. It's almost 99% ice by volume through an exposure of 20 meters. This gives you a distinct impression of how important ice may be in the dynamics of landscape evolution. Another feature here are these funny V-shaped things. You can see them sort of sporadically all across this natural exposure. These are called ice wedges. I think the next... An ice wedge occurs when the ground gets so cold and contracts that it cracks. And these cracks propagate considerable depth, 2, 3, 4, 5 meters into ground, depending on the actual stresses generated by thermal expansion and contraction. In the Arctic, these cracks will infill with a little bit of water as the spring develops, a bit of snow melt, this water infiltrates, forms a vertical vein of ice. These cracks will repeat year after year, not quite year after year, maybe 2 out of 3 years, 2 out of 4 years. But as a result, we accumulate very thick V-shaped bodies of ice called ice wedges. These ice wedges become important later on because the surface expression of these ice wedges, which are almost ubiquitous across the Arctic, are one of the features that we see a lot on Mars. The big question is, do they form the same way? So this is one thing I'll try to address as I move a bit further into the talk. Here's one of the questions that I asked Chris McKay when he first abducted me. I said, why do we explore space? I mean, This was at a time when two out of three Mars projects, missions, were basically doing great imitations of rocks hitting the ground. In fact, for a long time, the success rate for these Mars missions was less than 30%. And so the cost of each one is on, even back in the 60s, when a lot of these Mars missions started, were on the order of billions of dollars. And it's only the recent success of the Mir rovers, some of the orbiting platforms that produce these mind-boggling photographs of so much detail, more detail than we even get of the Earth, and then the most recent, the Phoenix lander, that we've suddenly been pulled back to this notion that NASA can actually do it. So it's an interesting aspect. So I asked him, why explore space? And ask any scientist, even ask Dave Williams, why explore space? And you'll have a pause. And then usually they become philosophical. You try to go online and look up space exploration, and it's incredibly philosophical. Every platform avoids the question. They talk about human nature, exploration, all these things. The one thing that comes out of it is curiosity. This is the one reason why we tend to justify our exploration in the modern sense of space. We want to know, as some of our early speakers talked about, the origin of the universe. We want to know the origin of life. We want to know, are we alone? The question of a single genesis versus multiple genesis. Are we a population of one in terms of populated species and planets and so on? The notion of habitability. Curiosity and knowledge, that's what really drives us. And this is where I think the notion of human nature, it's our nature to want to know. And it's at the basic roots of understanding where we belong in the cosmos, in the universe, and so on. But you go online, you find the application of economics. For every $1 spent by NASA in the space program, it generates $7 of revenue within their economy. In terms of the technologies that are developed through space exploration, every dollar spent generates $15 in terms of technological development. Then there you come across things like conquest, the notion of space and the space race as a geopolitical environment, and the need to get there first and to use space as a geopolitical environment. Then you often come across the term survival and necessity. The notion that at some point in the future the Earth is going to have so many people that it's going to have to rely on resources either beyond the extent of Earth, or in fact start moving people into outer space. This is the stuff of science fiction. But you try to find a straight answer online or from a scientist who's a specialist in space exploration, and you get such an array of BS, it's incredible. Anyways, so I thought I had to at least bring this up. And I think knowledge. And it's fitting that in this environment we talk about knowledge. And that's really what drives my interest in space science, knowledge. We think about targeted exploration. You know, that's where we have very specific goals and objectives. And one approach to overcoming the scientific and technological obstacles of that we face when trying to understand not just life on Mars, but how the Mars landscape occurred, is to develop a set of comparative tools. We want to look at places on Mars, the looks like, smells like type syndrome, and then find a place on Earth that looks like, smells like, but we have to take it one step further. We have to understand the fundamental physical processes, the environmental conditions, right from the most basic geology through to the climatic drivers to the geological evolution of the planet. A whole array of variables we have to understand in order to make this sort of analog approach work. However, by finding these places, we have an environment to test technologies, to take our rovers, to take our drills, to take our different analytical tools, and to see if they work. And so each of these environments that we take our technology to, or to test our capabilities, has to have some attributes that will allow us to better understand not just the system on Earth, but the potential target system that we're looking at on Mars.
it's useful that Earth and Mars had very similar early histories. And there are similar geologies. So some of the questions we have to ask when it comes to Mars aren't so challenging. We recognize that Earth evolved over the last, let's say, 2.5 billion years quite differently than Mars. That questions about life probably don't apply to today. We'll be excited if it does. It probably applies to an early Mars, a Mars about 2.5 billion years ago, a warmer, wetter Mars that probably was very similar in its geological and planetary evolution to Earth. And so these are the questions that we will ultimately have to address when we talk about life. But when we want to understand landforms and changes in the environment, we have a lot of modern processes that are comparable in nature. Okay, so what is an analog? Analog or analogical science is science in absentia. In other words, we're trying to figure out what's going on someplace where we're not. So we have to try to develop a series of criteria that allow us to understand something that we can probably see, and the next sort of order of magnitude, maybe touch remotely with a rover or maybe with a some kind of remote sensing tool, a geophysical tool. And then we have to be able to reconstruct it based on the knowledge that we have on Earth. So in other words, we have to have two parts to the analog. We have to have a source, and we have to have a target. The target is, in the Mars context, the landform, the environment that we're trying to understand. The source is that best example from Earth that replicates, to the best of our knowledge, that target environment. So this notion of source and target. And it's an important part of how we approach our understanding of landscapes, not just on Mars, but a number of other non-terrestrial environments, the Jovian moons, Europa, some of the moons of Saturn, Titan, Enceladus. These are all environments that are potential exploration targets within the next, if you talk again to NASA managers, they'll say Mars 20 years from now. They talk about the Jovian moons in a wishful sort of way where it's probably a century away. Nobody knows based on technology. Okay, so what are some of the analog environments that we have on Earth? I mean, I'm going to talk about polar regions. That's a no-brainer. Why polar regions? It's cold, it's dry. Mars is cold and dry. That's the primary connection. But what other analog environments are there? Dave Williams probably talked a bit about Project NEMO. Did he talk about NEMO last week? Because Dave is big into sort of submarine habitats and so on. Well, in that environment, we can test many human factors that have relevance to space exploration. So these environments are also, because of their isolation, because of the effect on the human physiology, these are also potential analog environments. So submarines, because submarine crews are in isolation sometimes for months. The whole psychology of isolation, which is a major factor in space exploration. Deserts. Deserts are probably the most common analog environment. The Atacama Desert is, according to Chris McKay, my friend Chris McKay, is the only place on Earth that he knows of that is void of life. He claims that it is so dry, it is the driest place on the planet, that there are places within the Atacama Desert that they're not even bacterial ecosystems. So, on Earth, that is probably the only place that is void of life. Therefore, it provides us, as a threshold of habitability, a target, a wonderful target for our analog studies. Mountain regions, cold, thinner air, isolation, role of elevation, so on. Caverns, the lack of light. This is a major challenge as we get further from the sun, is what kind of life forms survive with low levels of light or in the absence of light. And then we have a variety of government, university, and industrial facilities where we manipulate environments and replicate them. Everything from glove boxes through to complete laboratories that are bigger than this room, where we simulate Martian terrains and put rovers and drill systems. So we can have controlled environments as well. Okay,
So what are the attributes of an analog? And this is the last of the what I consider the boring stuff. So don't worry, the next half hour is not going to be full of this sort of technical detail. What are the five main attributes of an analog? Fidelity. How well does it represent your, how well does your source represent your target? And fidelity from the sense of as many of those parameters as possible. If it's a water-based landform, you want to look at everything from the source of the water to the material that's being acted upon to chemical processes, weathering processes. You want to analyze as many things as possible. And the closer you can get to your target, the better you are in terms of the fidelity, high-fidelity analog environments. The Arctic is considered a high-fidelity analog environment. Accessibility. You don't want your analog so challenging that they're as difficult to get to as Mars. And there are some places on Earth that are as difficult to get to as Mars. Some of these hydrothermal vents, the deep ocean canyons. These are environments which are wonderful analogs, but it's probably cheaper to put an orbiter around Mars than it is to explore some of these environments. Repeatability. You've got to be able to do, like any science, you've got to be able to go back and do it again. And you've got to have other people who have access to independently testing your observations to go back and do it also. So repeatability, affordability, again, cost and is hand in glove with accessibility. And utility, the notion that there's going to be benefits. The Arctic is again, one of those wonderful analog environments in terms of its utility because many of the technologies that we introduce in the Arctic, like the Ka-band satellite receiver that I was talking to you on 6 weeks ago. That's a technology that is very experimental. They said it couldn't be done. We did it. That's going to go into the northern communities. It's cheaper than the C-band satellite systems, which are being used at similar latitudes, not quite as far north, but similar latitudes. It's more efficient, more bandwidth, it's easier to control. And if you think of all kinds of other useful outcomes, if we think of Arctic science in general, you can think of parkas, which, you know, the Canadian snow goose parka is the parka of choice in Antarctica, the coldest place on the planet. Ken Bork, which is a Canadian airline company, is active anywhere it's cold and challenging. So our technologies that are developed through work in the Arctic, not just analog work, have valuable applications that can benefit not just the people of the North, but people across the globe. Okay, so Mars versus Earth. Sounds like a hockey game. There's no Canadians involved, so it must be hockey. What are the comparative terms of reference? What's a day? A day on Mars is 24 hours, 37 minutes. Day on Earth is 23 hours, 56 minutes. Pretty close. One revolution of the planet on Earth and Mars, they're pretty comparable. However, the time it takes the planet to orbit the Sun is almost double. 1 year on Mars is essentially 687 days as opposed to 365 and a quarter days. Mars, in terms of its mass, is approximately, let's say the diameter is just slightly more than half of the Earth, so we've got a planet that is almost half the size of, it's slightly greater than half the size of Earth. This has implications for gravity. Mars has a gravity that's about one-third, gravitational force that's one-third of Earth. This plays into many of the surface processes. A lot of the geological processes of landslides and water running down slopes. A key variable in the force and the energy that goes on in these systems is directly related to the force of gravity. Atmospheric pressure. It's less than 1/100th of the Earth's atmospheric pressure. This has a significant implication when it comes to the stability of water. And then you look at the temperature. The fact that the temperature on Mars in terms of an average temperature of about minus 60 degrees centigrade ranging between a maximum of 20, and most people don't realize that Mars actually, you know, in its equatorial area for a very brief period, has temperatures that get well above freezing, 20 degrees. As the other end of the spectrum, minus 140 degrees C. If we compare that with Earth, average temperature, it's between 13 and 15 degrees planetary temperature. The extreme cold on Earth, Vostok or the South Pole, has a mean temperature between minus 55 and minus 60. And the warmest places on Earth, and there's a competition for the warm places, whether it's Death Valley or some of the Eurasian deserts, on the order of plus 56 degrees, 100 degrees of variation. So we've got these benchmarks of comparison, which are very important, because now we start asking the question, looks like, smells like, are these comparable? So here we have essentially a source. This is a canyon formed by running water from Axel Heiberg Island. This is roughly 40, 50 kilometers from the McGill Arctic Research Station. And here we have a canyon of comparable size on Mars. And the prevailing wisdom in this case is, yes, it probably was formed by similar processes. It more than looks like, smells like. When we start looking at the structure of some of these valleys on Mars, we see secondary sources of information. We see indications of flow. They lead into other landforms. So landforms in association, not just a single form, not just a bump on the ground, not just a depression, not just a canyon, but its relationship to surrounding landforms as part of a landscape, and understanding landscapes and landscape dynamics, how one element of the landscape leads into the other, is an important part of how we understand analog relationships. So essentially then, we also have to ask ourselves, where does this information come from? How do we get, you know, pictures? This looks like a great picture. It's actually old. This is an old, I think this is in fact a Mariner picture from the 1970s. This is when we first started getting not high resolution, but pretty good resolution images of Mars. In the last 10 years, our capacity to understand and to develop these analogs has grown exponentially. When Viking landed on Mars, Viking 1 and Viking 2, back in the 1970s, we had our first camera on the surface. The first thing that Viking 1 saw was a dust storm. It saw clouds of dust, dust devils, things that are very common in arid environments, just twirling across the landscape in front of the camera. Now, we know that from 1971 to now, if you've bought a camera, a digital camera, you know that camera technology has improved enormously. The other technologies, just think of computers and the ability to do digital imagery, has changed enormously. So we start looking at the last 10 years, beginning with the Mars Global Surveyor. And believe it or not, Mars Global Surveyor is still one of the biggest and best sources of information, the Mars Orbital Camera, the Mach camera. Some of the images I'll show you shortly are from the Mach camera. Then Odyssey, Mars Odyssey, and these first two are NASA-based projects. We know there was water on Mars. That's never been in doubt. We could see the ice caps. I mean, we can see the ice caps with telescopes from Earth. Sure, we speculated there were ice caps, but when you see blobs of white at the poles of a planet that's controlled in terms of temperature by latitudinal gradients, it's a pretty good guess that it's an ice cap. Now, whether it was water ice or CO2 ice, that was unclear. And it's only been in the last few years that we know the relative, or we have a good guess anyways, the relative proportions of water ice, H2O ice, and carbon dioxide ice, dry ice. The southern ice cap has components of dry ice. We at one point thought the southern ice cap, because it's colder, was more carbon dioxide than it was water. Now, the recent information coming from Odyssey and its gamma spectrometer tells us, no, there's a lot more water ice there than we originally thought. Mars Express, its camera system, and it flew a radar, a ground-penetrating radar. Radar is basically these radar systems are neat. I'm going to show you some pictures in a minute of ones that we use. It just sends out an energy pulse, like a radio wave. And this radio wave will bounce and refract and propagate through other materials. And by measuring the reflections of these refracted and reflected waves, you start making interpretations about subsurface conditions. MARSIS, the ground-penetrating radar, has started telling us a little bit about the subsurface structure. Then we've got Mars Exploration Rovers, the Mir rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. We finally could take a walkabout on Mars. And these things are miracles. These two rovers alone have redeemed NASA.
You know, it was the cheaper, faster formula that built the Mir rovers. They were supposed to last on 60 Mars sols, 60 Mars days. They've lasted, in fact, they're still going. They've basically lasted almost 5 years, and they're still going. One's got a bit lame, but they're still going. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, these have the high-rise camera. Again, pictures of such detail that we're now starting to be able to look at some of the context of these analogs. And then, obviously, things like the Phoenix lander. And Phoenix, this is probably the crown jewel in NASA's Royal Martian family, because it validated so many uncertainties and questions about the presence of water or ice in the Martian soils, the history of some of these soils, and so Phoenix has pretty well died its quiet death. It lasted a bit longer than expected. What are the future? Well, there's ESA's Mars Sample Return 2018, and then the scout missions, which Phoenix was a scout mission, and I'm going to talk briefly, I'll mention the scout missions later on. There's more scout missions supposedly on the way. Current, you know, obviously, the global economy influences the strategies of most space agencies, whether it's the European Space Agency, the Canadian Space Agency, or you know, the U.S. Space Agency. Okay, so we've got these host of tools, Viking, Mariner, Global Surveyor, Mir rovers, Phoenix. We're starting to get some compelling evidence of things that we've speculated all along, that there's evidence that Mars at some point in its past was very different than it is today. The notion that Mars was a warmer, wetter environment has pretty well been confirmed. How warm, how wet? Well, the how wet is pretty easy given the scale of some of the landforms. How warm is still unclear, and the current, it's a debated topic. I'm on the side, obviously, and my colleagues at NASA Ames and JSC are on the same side, that Mars, even at its warmest, was about as warm as today's Earth's polar environments, the Arctic. So bingo, here we have this environment going on today on Earth that's going to give us tremendous opportunity for insight into Mars. So I'm just going to go through some of these sort of looks like, smells like scenarios and give you a sense of where this kind of science is going. And again, here we have this is a high-rise image. It's off one of the orbiters. And it gives us and these are of more or less the same scale. It gives us some evidence of an alluvial fan, a deposit that we are very confident is directly related to running water and changing physics within the turbulent flow of the water. And here we have an equivalent alluvial fan, again from Axel Heiberg Island. Groundwater, this, you know, liquid water. This is the goal to find liquid water on Mars. And again, here we have a mock image that shows structures that are pretty similar to areas where we have modern day groundwater discharge. Some of these structures, oops, way to go, Wayne. Some of these gullies, because of the very slow pace of landscape change on Mars, some of these gullies can last for millions of years, where they don't last for millions of years on Earth. However, there are other processes that go on in terms of the way dust and sediment gets deposited, the way micrometeorites, which literally rain out on Mars. And Mars would be a tough place to live because you'd be ducking micrometeorites on a regular basis. The number of hits per sort of unit area is pretty high. And so you get these landscapes which have either fewer or no micrometeorite impacts, because again, our high-rise imagery, which gives us sub-meter resolution, would see these. We know that they're relatively young. Again, young, millions of years, not decades, not centuries. And here, basically, we have a spring system. We have similar hills and gullies. We have groundwater. Something that does occur widely on Mars are these white precipitates, which are linked to groundwater as well. On Earth, these are salts. These are naturally precipitating salts because of the rapid freezing and evaporation of water in cold, dry environments. This obviously doesn't have the salts, but there are several sites. So here we have something that not only looks like, smells like, but we're starting to build a compelling argument based on other features within the landscape. And so we can go through a similar, these sorts of gullies. Gully erosion is again, one of the topics that is most hotly debated, is because what is the mechanism of gully formation? How long do they take to form? What's their relationship to the landscape, rates of erosion, and so on? And so here we have a crater wall and gullies, and in many cases alluvial fans forming at the base of the gullies. And here we have a similar structure. Some of these crater walls will have volcanic geologic units that help cap them. And here we have similar, modern day, this is again Axel Heiberg Island. It's literally across the river from our camp. And something else that we get are various forms of mass wasting. Here we have a rock glacier on the side of Olympus Mons. Olympus Mons is the largest volcano in the solar system. It's huge. And here we have a rock glacier, a slope, a gravity-driven landform that goes down the sides of Olympus Mons. And here, and these structures here on Bastion Ridge, here's one that's up close. This isn't quite a rock glacier, but it's one of these landforms that's transitional from debris sliding down the slope, being laminated with ice and turning into a flow feature. And these are called protalus ramparts or pronival ramparts. But again, they have very similar shapes, forms, and of a very similar scale. And we can start looking at the material, and we realize that they're formed of very similar materials. Probably one of the more compelling comparative features are sand dunes. Again, we have a series of sand dunes from Mars and similarly from Antarctica. And these are in the Wright and Victoria Valleys in Antarctica. And as the sand blows around, it shapes the rocks. Here we have a rock, a ventifact, that's shaped by sand blowing over the surface, taken by the pan camera on the Spirit rover and Gusev crater. And here we have similar ventifacts from the Wright Valley in Antarctica. Here I mentioned these polygonal patterns of ice wedges. Here's these polygons on Mars, and here's polygons in Antarctica and in the high Arctic. Again, the looks like, smells like argument is the start. It's when we start doing more detailed research on these things that we start either confirming the value of these analogs or throw them out. And here's, remember I said that the ice wedge that accumulates under these polygons, well, here's one of those ice wedges. So the question of whether or not we have an ice type wedge body under these troughs is one of the, again, one of these more controversial topics. And then smaller scale polygons. Here's a picture that was taken by the Phoenix pan camera. Here's a picture that's taken essentially at the where our satellite dish is on Axel Heiberg Island. Essentially the exact same scale, very similar distributions of sediments. Whether they're formed by the same processes, that's what has to be studied in more detail. Ground ice, here we have the image from Odyssey. This is the gamma spectrometer. This is from this is the Marsis image, which is a GPR image. And it shows the presence of ice. This shows the distribution of hydrogen. And in this kind of concentrations, hydrogen bonds with oxygen, and therefore it's taken as a proxy for ice. And this is essentially a GPR, a radar profile, that shows a distinct transition of two layers as we come off the northern ice cap on Mars. And it's deemed to represent a body of ice that's buried by sediment. In the Arctic, we see these concentrations of ice in the sediment, and we can see layers of ice, which might be analogous to these sorts of things. So here are some of the examples. Basically, the last one I just wanted to show is not limited to Mars, that we can go to Europa. Here's one of the Galileo images as it passed by Europa, showing a surface of ice blocks, a fractured ice cover. And here we have a lake. It's an ice dam lake, again, within our study area on Axel Heiberg Island, which has tabular icebergs. This lake has icebergs that have approximately 10, 20 feet of freeboard. That means they've, 6, 7 to 10 meters of freeboard, which means, there's 100 meters of ice below the surface. This lake is on the order of 200 meters deep. So it's an ideal environment to test some of the questions that we might want to ask on Europa. Okay, so now this is the looks like, smells like. Now we have to ask some serious questions. So the next 10, 15 minutes, I'm going to give you how we ask these serious questions. We're going to take you to the McGill Arctic Research Station on Axel Heiberg Island. Here's Axel Heiberg. It's got ice caps, again, which is, makes it a nice sort of comparative landscape for Mars. 80 degrees north, mean annual temperature of about minus 19 degrees. It's cold. Permafrost is over 500 meters deep. It's about 4,000 kilometers from Montreal. The current airfare from Montreal or Ottawa to Resolute Bay is $5,000. So it's not cheap. And you know, I sort of talked about affordability. The only thing that's more expensive is probably a flight to Mars. And here are some of the structures that we're talking about. Next year is our 50th anniversary. I'm going to have a party. It's just how I'm going to get people there, I don't know. Here's the old facility. Very quickly, I'm going to give you some setting. This lake is a naturally acidic lake. It's got a pH of about 3.3 to 3.5. That's the same as vinegar. You know, that's our water source. However, you would think, oh, my God, you know, how can you drink that? You know, I'm more worried about the aluminum that's in it than I am the acidity. The acidity comes from leaching of sulfides that are in this ridge here. And it just gives it a bit of a metallic taste. It doesn't even curdle the milk. This station was created mainly to study the glaciers in this area. And this area actually has the longest continuous record of glacial change in the high Arctic. 50 years of mass balance record. So this is the old station. We've just been funded through IPY to renovate this station. We've got about $200,000. That's not much. I'm going to build a new kitchen. That's all I'm going to do. This is the new station. This is a station that was funded by the Canadian Space Agency as part of the Canadian Analog Research Network. It funded three sites. There's a second site in the Arctic on Devon Island called Devon Crater or the Houghton Crater Mars Project. There's our site, and then there's a site in British Columbia called Pavilion Lake. Here's the structure, and we've got basically a series of temporary structures. Appreciate the fact that in the Arctic, if you build it, you've got to be able to take it down. And so the more money you put into a structure, the more money it's going to take to get it down. This building is remarkably cheap and remarkably easy to take apart. It's based on sunroom architecture, yet it has an R value that is unbelievable. We heat this at minus 40. When I talked to you earlier in the series, it was minus 40 outside and it was plus 20 inside. We have to open the windows. It gets so hot. It's that good at keeping the heat in. That's what it looks like inside. We have a solar power system. We have a wind generator. It's used as our scientific base of operations. We have a series of temporary structures called polar havens and weather havens that people live and sleep in. Here's our satellite receiver. This is what allowed me to talk to you. Essentially, the analog studies at Mars are physical, biological, and technological in nature. The physical studies are based on geology, permafrost questions like ground ice and polygonal ground, hydrology, chemistry, lake deposits, limnology. The biological questions pertain to the microbial communities linked to some of these features. And then the technological questions deal with the applied technologies that we use to study these environments. Things like geophysics, radar, and resistivity, field microscopes, and various forms of field chemical and analytical tools. Okay, so basically the main focus of the work are these perennial springs. Right now we have mapped out 8 sets of springs around the island. They range dramatically in hydrogeology and geomorphology from these sorts of springs, which there's a group of 40 outlets. These are cold springs. These aren't hot springs. This isn't Yellowstone-type hot water. The water discharges at temperatures between minus 5 and plus 5 degrees, and most of them are sub-freezing. How does the water stay liquid? It's got salt in it. Some of these springs are literally saturated in salt. Then you throw a bit of calcium chloride in. You have freezing depressions on the order of minus 20. We even have some that have freezing depressions on the order of minus 30 degrees. There's a lake in Antarctica called Don Juan Pond that's a hyperchloride lake that's still, and it's saturated with calcium chloride, it's still liquid at minus 50 degrees. So you throw a bit of chemicals in, and it changes the dynamics. So here's essentially a quick summary of some of those properties that I've just mentioned. And here are a range of some of the spring morphologies, everything from well-developed eaves trough structures to these microtravertines. We've measured constant rates of discharge. This is the air temperature. This is the spring water temperature. That's the flow rate. And this is over a 12-month cycle. So we know these things flow in the winter. That was the biggest challenge we had to overcome, is proving they flow in the winter. Our chemistry does conform to the sorts of conditions we'd need to maintain liquid flow at cold temperatures. High in sodium, high in chloride, and essentially high in most sort of salts that will help depress freezing temperatures. And we've got microbial communities, filamentous bacteria, and we have various forms of carbonate structures. We also have some unusual minerals, and the value of these minerals is that we can study these minerals as a potential preservation environment for the bacteria. A colleague here at McGill, Hajatola Valley, looks at these in his SEMTM lab to try and find biofilms on the various mineral precipitates. By looking at these sorts of features in the Arctic, we know how to plan for the Antarctic. And ultimately, what we need to do on Mars. So we look at these things under various levels of enlargement, and we start understanding the structure and the relationship of any microbial community to the geologic environment. In fact, the role of bacteria in helping precipitate some of these minerals. These are a set of springs that are saturated in sodium chloride, and they precipitate out a hydrous mineral called hydrohalite. Hydrohalite is salt that actually, it's not salt, strictly speaking. It's essentially a combination of salt and water as part of the same mineral. And the interesting thing about this mineral is that at temperatures of minus 20, we have this very unique geology that forms. Once it gets above freezing, this whole structure collapses. The water drains, and all the salt just turns into a river of rock salt like you would see on the road. So we have this environment, which is very unique from a winter perspective. Ice wedge polygons. I mentioned these polygons before. We have a study that's currently going on that's looking at the geometry and doing statistical analysis on intersections and developing these transfer functions that will tell us about the dimensions of the polygons as they pertain to subsurface conditions, the relative presence or absence of ice. So we're using a series of geophysical tools. We're using ground-penetrating radar. We're using resistivity to map the distribution of these ice wedge polygons. We're linking it to the spatial patterns. And now we're actually starting to make predictions about some of the Martian subsurface conditions based on what we've been able to unfold with respect to these Arctic polygons. Ground ice is another feature that we really do want to have a better understanding. We know that on Mars there's considerable amounts of ground ice. In fact, all this water that formed the rivers, the big question is, where did it go? The prevailing wisdom is that much of it degassed into space, given the limitations of the Mars atmosphere. But the wisdom also says that a lot of it's in the ground still, in the form of ice. So we do these very detailed studies on the stratigraphy of ice, the topography of the ice, and the distribution of the ice with respect to local topographies, and some of the internal structure, the petrography of the ice, and it becomes part of a model that we're using to predict the actual distribution of ice vertically based on some of the surface soil conditions and the climatic conditions. And then we're doing all kinds of sampling, subsurface sampling, as a life detection and contamination. This is a study where we're using a standard permafrost corer. We're soaking the drill with a series of fluorescent microspheres. They're bactericide microspheres, but they're fluorescent. And we're basically coring down in. We're achieving these cores. Okay, here we see the core barrel with these fluorescent microspheres. And then we're sampling the core, essentially from the outside in, and we're finding the degree to which, first of all, contamination will actually reach into the frozen samples. This is one of the major concerns on any kind of Mars sample return is what kind of contamination that we could introduce in the environment, how will it be found within the system. This is 1, 2, 4, and 6 millimeters from the outside of the core. The green dots are the microspheres. The blurred ones are background fluorescence. And so once we get essentially 6 millimeters in, we've almost completely gone beyond the penetration depth of our microspheres, and at 1 centimeter we didn't find one. So we're doing studies to look at how to sample Mars and contamination questions. In terms of technology, we're looking at geophysics. Here's a series of survey environments for our ground-penetrating radar. This ground-penetrating radar system was the basis of a Mars Scout mission that was in the competition with Phoenix. When the Scout competition was held about 5 years ago, everyone knew Phoenix would win. It was on the shelf already. However, there was a possibility of a second Scout mission being funded. At that time, NASA had a formula with Canada that would allow Canada to support one-third of the Scout mission. They were finite, remember, quicker, faster, cheaper. There was a $450 million ceiling on these. Canada could contribute up to $150 million. On this one, it was the American lead was Chris McKay. I was the Canadian lead. It was called Long Day's Drive. And the main tool here was a Canadian-made ground-penetrating radar, and it was designed to map ground ice. There were a series of other tools that were going to be included in terms of surficial material and so on. This was ranked about fourth in the competition. We were close, but no cigar. And here's some of the radar data. Here's GPR. This is resistivity. This is how we mapped out an ice body. And so we demonstrated fairly conclusively the value of these geophysical tools. And this is a three-dimensional map once we start doing multiple surveys. I know I was going to run out of time, so basically this is the end. Thank you for your attention. I really do have to acknowledge some of the sources of funding here. Actually, there's the most important one's missing, and that's McGill. But Polar Continental Shelf is the government logistics agency, NSERC, of course, because they have money into almost everything we do. Canadian Space Agency is a major funder of this project. NASA's ASTID and exobiology programs, ArcticNet CFI, and the Northern Scientific Training Program. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks, Wayne. And I'll ask if people could write down legibly questions for Wayne afterwards. And while we're waiting up here, I'll give Wayne his wonderful parting gift. Appropriate for someone in the High Arctic, I hope. You'll find good use for it.
Thank you.
I'll find this little. I think there's someone.
Here. Yeah.
Nice. Oh, nice. Beer mounted.
Thank you.
I'm having my questions sorted. Oh, they're sorted. Thanks. Okay. So, oh, very good handwriting on this particular question. Thank you very much. Okay, Wayne, here we go. Magnetic fields play an important role in Earth's Arctic and Antarctic radiation exposure. Does Mars have similar magnetic fields, and is this an important analog consideration? Huh.
As I understand, the magnetic field on Mars is actually quite light. It goes to the global tectonics. The fact that Mars is one-third the size of Earth, it never fully developed the models for structure in terms of the core, mantle, and crust, and the convection within it. So Mars has a very low magnetic field, which means it's exposed more to high levels of solar radiation. So the critical question will be is tolerances for solar radiation. This has a significant implication for life, and the notion is that life will probably be well down in the soil. It won't be on the surface, and it has implications for human exploration as well.
It's kind of a related question as well. Since the atmosphere is so thin and all these little meteorites, I didn't know about that at all, how would life survive radiation on Mars in their thin atmosphere?
Well, I think the notion that extant life doesn't exist. It's not there right now. And probably couldn't survive unless it's deep within the crust. We are starting now to find on Earth in some of the deep mines, chemosynthetic bacteria, kilometers into the crust, bacteria that don't need light, photosynthesis. So if there is life on Mars today, it's probably deeper within the crust.
However, in the past, the wetter, warmer Mars probably had a more significant atmosphere. Mars' atmosphere is a CO2 atmosphere today. It probably has always been predominantly a CO2 atmosphere. So life in the past may have had a better chance at surviving. But again, the bombardment was always a question in terms of success of life on Earth. During periods of great bombardment, the notion was life would start and then get blasted out of existence. So this whole notion of sustaining life has always been a problem and probably remained a problem on Mars.
I have two kind of related questions here. Is there any wildlife up on Axel Heiberg Island? And do you have polar bears around your camp? And if so, what do you do to protect yourselves?
There's lots of wildlife. And it's the food chain. The whole food chain goes by. Everything from, and surprisingly, sides of, everyone thinks in terms of caribou, muskoxen, foxes, wolves, little ermine, lemmings. They're all there in great numbers. In fact, this trip when I was there, this spring, we had a few unusual animals for that time of year. We had ravens and snowy owls. Bears, yes, but it's on a side of the Arctic archipelago that's still heavily congested by perennial pack ice. This is changing very quickly, but the presence of ice year-round limits the seal populations, which are the main food source for polar bears. So the success rate or the survival rate of polar bears is directly related to the seal populations, and so with the low seal populations, there's very few bears. We've had evidence of bears in the immediate vicinity of the camp. In the 20 years I've worked there, we've never seen a bear.
So here's kind of an interesting one. We hear a lot about the Arctic ice disappearing. And is there, in the future, will there be enough permafrost up there so that your research can continue? Or will there be a degradation of the permafrost?
I'm planning my retirement. At that latitude, permafrost will probably survive. What we'll see is that area that I identified as discontinuous permafrost, that patchy, thinner permafrost, that in all probability will disappear. There's enough of a buffer that it will take a long time for it to disappear. What we're starting to see in terms of climate change-driven problems relate to where there's secondary disturbances, let's say where a pipeline exists or a road, where in fact we've added a complicating factor to the thermodynamics of permafrost. That's where the problems exist. The southern limit has always been dynamic and coming and going on a regular basis. So if I were to live 100 years, I still think I'd be able to keep doing the work I'm doing, but it would be a little bit more comfortable.
Just got related interesting questions. How different is the Antarctic from the Arctic for doing this sort of research, and why is it worth doing both rather than just going to the best one?
The differences are significant, primarily where we go in the Antarctic, and that's the main factor, of course. Antarctica is 99% ice covered, and there's pockets of ice-free areas around the perimeter. And then some of them, there's the Transantarctic Mountains, which go through the side of Antarctica, which produces sort of islands of rock. Where we go in the McMurdo Dry Valleys, it's the largest unglaciated area, which is still relatively, it's measured in thousands of square kilometers. It's not that huge. Has the highest life form are soil nematodes. And so there's no vegetation. There is, the only life that may adventure in there might be the odd skua, the odd bird that flies in, or the misguided penguin and seal that heads up the valleys as opposed to going back out on the ice. So we have what is probably a one order of magnitude more extreme set of conditions, not just the cold. Cold is only one variable. The temperatures in the dry valleys aren't that different from what we have in the high Arctic. The presence of ice in the permafrost means that on the annual cycle we get a bit more water and therefore vegetation. It hasn't been geographically isolated for basically millions of years, so we've had successions of animals come in. But Antarctica has remained pretty well isolated, and so it is an extreme case.
Okay, this one I was wondering too. Where the heck is the Atacama Desert?
Atacama Desert?
Yeah.
It's it's Chile. It goes all the way up Chile to basically the northern tip of Chile, and it's essentially a it's driven by the mountains, and essentially it's a rain shadow.
This is just a review, because I think you did say this in your talk, but could you go over again why perennial springs don't freeze in the high Arctic, and is there any reason to think the same mechanism would occur in Mars?
The setting in the Arctic, and there's one geological element I didn't mention, and that's the presence of a series of gypsum domes and salt domes. These salt domes occur geologically where you've had an ocean evaporate. The salts that are dissolved in the oceans are precipitated. Through several cycles of evaporation, we accumulate thick layers of salt. These are primary targets for oil and gas exploration. Salt is a low-density mineral, and so it will viscously deform and come up through the overlying geology, because all these salt layers are covered by literally thousands of meters of other materials, rocks. So the salt domes come up, and it's produced a geologic situation which, one, means that any sub-permafrost groundwater comes in contact with relatively pure geologically formed salt deposits, so it quickly takes on a high salt concentration and all the other minerals that are typical of oceans. And so we have a range of salts. And so the water becomes, to varying degrees, different concentrations of dissolved salts, right up to saturation. And so water saturated with salt only begins to freeze at minus 20.7 degrees. What will happen is that that water will fractionate out the salt. So at minus 20, it will begin to freeze. Now, if the mean temperature at Axel Heiberg is about minus 20, it gets warmer through the permafrost. It's driven by the heat flow from inside the Earth. So if we have a geothermal gradient, the rate of temperature change within the crust near the surface, about 1 degree per 30 meters, and we have minus 20 at the surface, then 20 meters down it's minus 19, and so on. So we can go down to 600 meters. So as you get deeper into the permafrost, it's a lot warmer as well. So even water that isn't saturated in salt, that stays liquid at temperatures of minus 7, can still flow through these frozen sediments. Now, whether or not that exists on Mars, there is indication of hydrous minerals. Jarosite, which is a I can't remember its full geological. It's an iron-rich phosphate-type mineral, which has water attached to it. We have a series of calcium carbonate minerals and salt-based minerals, sodium chloride minerals, which have salt. And there's a whole range. Even gypsum is a hydrated mineral. The potential for water being stored in these minerals is an important part of it. So the analog value isn't the specifics of the water-salt concentrations that we have. It's the hydrogeology, the fact that you can have deep groundwater sources that are picking up dissolved minerals and the interaction of those waters with overlying geologies and their ability to flow through frozen material.
Yeah, if I remember right, like 0 Fahrenheit is actually the coldest you can get with salt-saturated water.
Yeah.
Okay, here are two related ones to which I think I know the answer, but we'll see what Wayne has to say. The Arctic in deep winter is a horribly cold place to go up north then as well, and so I think I know the answer, so you guys do as well. Would you go to Mars given the chance, and what would be the first thing you'd study?
The question I ask all my grad students, especially when we set up the camp and we're sitting there, we've had dinner, everyone pulls out their bottle of scotch, and we start, there's a lot of scenarios we discuss, and one of them is, would you go to Mars? And they all almost, without exception, say yes. And I said, well, what if it's a one-way ticket? Would you still go? And without exception, they all say no. They want to come back. And then they say, well, what about you? And I said, yeah, I'd go, even if it was a one-way ticket. And I think what I would study, I don't think there's any one thing I'd be looking at. It's the whole landscape. If I have one skill as a geomorphologist, somebody that studies landscape dynamics, it's understanding whole landscapes, not just single elements of it. And so being able to look at a Martian landscape, I think, would be just, it'd be worth dying for.
Sure. In your research, are jobs provided for indigenous people in the polar research project?
This has been a changing dynamic in terms of our interaction, especially since the creation of Nunavut in 1999. And as the local indigenous governments have become more powerful and more organized, a condition of our licensing and our land use permits is often local hiring. One of the biggest challenges we face is you know, trying to find somebody that can either contribute to the science, which is very difficult. So we try to either have groups, elders, where maybe a traditional knowledge in changing landscape may be part. In the end, we usually get a game monitor. And that's the best we can do. The current rate for a game monitor is $350 a day for somebody that stands around with a shotgun. We have no choice. That's a condition of our land use permit. On Axel Heiberg Island, because it's crown land, we usually have an Inuk game monitor for only part of the season. They get homesick and they don't want to hang out, so they go home. But when we work elsewhere in the Arctic, what we usually try to do is hire somebody who will actually help us organize the camp, run the camp, and so on. And wherever possible, we take students. I do science camps. Believe it or not, I've done two science camps on Axel Heiberg Island for the students, high school students from Grease Fjord, which is 450 kilometers away. And my wife is a teacher with the Katowice School Board, and used to be with the Nunavut Teacher Education Program. Was actually a former director of the NTEP program here, and so I give courses all through the Arctic and usually field courses where I work with a teacher and an elder, trying to and that satisfies some of the requirement to interact with the community is the most important thing, not to work in isolation. So by participating with the community, that sort of relieves some of the responsibility. Sometimes the high cost of taking somebody literally 450 kilometers from their home where they don't want to be.
That's great. Now, the next question is, I'm concerned about Canadian sovereignty, and everyone knows you're way, way up there. Do you have issues with that in the Arctic?
Sovereignty is very much an expression of occupation. And the fact that McGill's had this field station, the only facility on Axel Heiberg Island, there's no communities there. The last indigenous community was probably 1,000 to 2,000 years ago when the Arctic was probably a very different place. We are alone up there, and therefore our presence represents a significant Canadian occupation. This year, literally days after we did the teleconference, one of the sovereignty patrols, or two of the sovereignty patrols, which are the joint forces, the DND plus the Rangers, who do the Skidoo patrols, we had arranged for them to be based out of our camp. So this year we had two groups of eight Rangers come into the camp. That new facility, they took it over for about a week. We had representatives from the Danish military. We had the head of the commandant for the joint forces. So we work with the military wherever possible. And I think it does help Canadian sovereignty.
In your talk, you spent a lot of time showing parallels between Earth and Mars. So what's your best guess on the timeline of age between Mars and Earth?
I think the critical understanding, and I have to admit that I'm a terrestrial scientist. My students are Mars scientists, and I try to give them the best skills to understand Mars. I'm an old dog, and these new tricks are hard to learn for me to understand, to transfer the actual physics of what I study to Mars. In terms of the prevailing understanding, when you look at a lot of these landforms and the fact that some of these landforms are very old in appearance, I kind of buy into the prevailing wisdom of probably 1.5 to 2.5 billion years in terms of when it was inactive. But there are many that argue that climate change, that it may be hundreds of millions of years, that the obliquity of Mars, because it goes through an extremely high change in obliquity, that if you change the obliquity, you actually change some of the potential climate. I can't remember what the obliquity is right now. I should think. It's 23 degrees or something.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Now we only have time for one last question, which is mine. Is the best way to support science at McGill by providing a philanthropic gift to the faculty? Oh, that's too easy. That's too easy for weighing. I had to do that at least once. But here's a real question. Could we, you've all this experience with, there's only one little place in Chile where there's no life on Earth. Could we accidentally or on purpose seed Mars with life?
There is a whole structure within all the international space agencies that deal with planetary protection. And the concern about contamination is as great as the contamination of bringing foreign organisms back to Earth. The whole challenge of sample handling, as well as an instrument or a rover or a lander that goes into Mars, is a big deal. So it is a serious concern. It's probably one of the highest priorities. And it's essentially all the space agencies that launch these missions have to have a sterilization process whereby the whether it's a hydrogen sulfide bath that the instruments are washed in transit so that they do not transport any Earth-born organisms to their foreign or their remote destinations.
Well, with that, we draw to a close Mini Science 2009. I'll see you guys a year from now on Mini Science 2010. Thanks for coming and making this a great success. Thanks, Wayne. A great closure to one series.
Thanks, Wayne.